Inflation looks different depending on where you sit. Just ask Japan. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, January 18th. Good to have you with us. We talk a lot about the Federal Reserve on this show, especially lately, with inflation and the Fed's fight against it top of mind in the American economy. But today we're going to start off with another central bank, the Bank of Japan, because while its counterparts in the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere have been raising interest rates to beat back inflation, the Japanese central bank has taken a different approach. Today, the Bank of Japan surprised markets by keeping its ultra-low rates where they are. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has that story.
Unlike most of the world, Japan has been battling very low inflation for decades. The recent rise in global energy and food prices has changed that. Sebastian Mallaby of the Council on Foreign Relations says policymakers there hope some of that sticks.
Now they're thinking, great, let's just hold on to this opportunity to finally get inflation psychology shifted in Japan.
Mallaby says low inflation hasn't encouraged Japanese consumers to spend, which would help stimulate the economy.
As consumers see that inflation is 4%, maybe they'll start to think, hey, I better buy that washing machine today, because if I wait until next year, it'll be 4% more expensive.
Decades in the economic doldrums have prompted the Bank of Japan to pioneer all kinds of newfangled monetary policy tools. The latest is the yield curve control policy. That means the bank is limiting the interest rate on long-term government bonds. In December, it raised that cap slightly, leading to expectations it would join other big central banks and push interest rates higher. It didn't, says the University of Michigan's Catherine Dominguez.
In fact, it looks like it was a slight pivot and a hold, as opposed to a marching down a new path.
The reluctance to make any big moves may stem from the imminent departure of Bank of Japan Governor Haruhiko Kuroda, who spent a decade at the helm, says Guy Labat of Janney Montgomery Scott.
There's legitimate debate as to whether he'd be the one to want to end the yield curve control if it is time to do so, or whether he would rather wait for his replacement to make that decision.
A replacement with time to see changes through and manage any fallout. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Back in the U.S., we know people experience inflation differently depending on their circumstances, even their race and ethnicity. It's called inflation inequality. And today, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York is out with new research showing how higher prices in certain categories have hit people of color harder. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
47-year-old Tammy Gates figures she spends more than a third of her income feeding herself and her two kids. Her monthly grocery bill about doubled during the pandemic to as much as $500 a month.
You would see that number and think, oh my goodness, you're buying a lot of groceries, but not really.
Gates is African American, a single mom in Jacksonville, Florida. She makes $42,000 a year in a sales job. Gates spends $50 a week on gas, and a year ago she had to move after a private investor bought her building and raised the rent from $950 to $1,600 a month.
He had the opinion that even that was low, so I felt like even from there he could go higher.
The New York Fed report found that Black and Latino households dealt with higher than average rates of inflation over the past few years. Gary Hoover, an economist at Tulane University, says that's because consumers like Gates spend a bigger proportion of their budgets on necessities that were hardest hit by inflation.
Housing costs, food costs, and transportation, which is going to be the majority of the budget. And you can only stretch that so far.
Century Foundation senior fellow Julie Cashin says the Fed's cure for inflation, higher interest rates to cool off the economy, can also disproportionately affect people of color because they're more likely to work in service jobs.
For example, restaurant, retail, that those are some of the sectors that are going to be impacted first, because if people are not spending money to go to restaurants, if people are not shopping, then the people who work in those places are going to be impacted.
And Cashin says if those workers did lose their jobs, it would be more expensive for them to borrow money to make ends meet. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
One last note about the Fed. Chairman Jerome Powell has tested positive for COVID. According to a statement from the Board of Governors, he's experiencing mild symptoms and working from home. On Wall Street today, kind of a woeful Wednesday. We'll have details when we do the numbers. The postmortem on the holiday retail season continues with today's report from the Commerce Department on retail sales for December, which were down by 1.1%, the second monthly decline in a row. The numbers are not adjusted for inflation and reflect a decline in some prices, including gasoline. So that's the official read on the retail economy. For a view from the shop floor, we turn to Irene Kesselman of Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina. She's one of our retail regulars, and she shared this update on how things are going.
Our inventory right now is being replenished from the busy selling season. This week alone, we received over 150 boxes of merchandise, and we are getting it out as quickly as we can. We are a small store, and we usually are packed to the gills. And when we receive merchandise, the boxes sometimes are literally almost to three quarters of the way up the wall, and it's hard to walk and get around. And with that comes opening them, checking them in, as well as then, you know, putting price stickers on them and getting them out on the floor. In terms of prices for this year, we're still faced with seeing items come through with increases. We have seen anywhere from 5 to 20% increases on some of the things that we have brought into the store. So, you know, I'll continue to look at pricing as I buy. And if I have to raise prices, I will, but there will be plenty of times, I'm sure, where I also will decide to take a lower markup. My staff right now looks good for the beginning of the year. We had some temporary help during the holidays, and we still have temporary help as well as staff that has been with us for over 10 years. And I will look at staff during the course of the year and see where we need to add, if at all. I will be meeting with salespeople for the next 2 to 3 weeks. And at that time, they will show me new and exciting merchandise, I hope. Many of my reps carry 75 lines, so one appointment could take literally an entire day. And it will take me probably 2 to 4 months to fill the store again, because by the time I see them and then I spread out the deliveries. And then, of course, Easter this year is early, and that's always a huge consideration as a retailer because it just means that we have to have Easter product in earlier this year.
That was Irene Kesselman stocking up the store shelves at Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina. By the way, Commerce breaks down the monthly retail report by the type of business. Turns out toy stores fall under the category sporting goods, hobby, musical instrument, and bookstores, where sales were up 0.1% in December. The Sundance Film Festival gets underway tomorrow in Park City, Utah. It's the first in-person gathering in 3 years after last year's last-minute switch to a virtual festival amidst the Omicron surge. At the time, Marketplace's Savannah Marr talked to disappointed business owners in Park City who were counting on the boost in visitors. Now, with Sundance and other big events back for real, we asked Savannah for an update.
Last year, Park City Peaks Hotel was fully booked for the entire Sundance Festival, until word came that Sundance was happening on Zoom.
Your heart sank when you heard the news.
Sean Rayner is director of sales at the hotel, which was abruptly 90% vacant for what's typically one of its most lucrative weeks.
You know, you just go into scramble mode.
The hotel was able to offload some rooms to skiers at a discounted rate. Still, Rayner says the cancellation was a financial blow. This is a familiar story all over the world, says Steve Heap with the Association of Festival Organizers.
From public transport, taxi companies, bars, grocery shops, you name it, they all took a pasting.
2022 was supposed to bring the event industry's triumphant return. The virus had other plans.
In fact, it became known as the let's get by year.
In 2023, businesses are gearing up for events that they hope will feel something like normal.
Our vice president of operations always refers to South by Southwest as our Super Bowl.
Mason Ayer owns Kirby Lane Cafe in Austin, Texas. Pre-pandemic, the restaurant was open 24 hours and a popular spot for midnight pancakes during the festival.
Particularly during South by Southwest, those 24-hour operations were extremely important to us.
But this year, he's facing a labor shortage, so...
We're not going to have that this year.
And at Park City Peaks, Sean Rayner says tourists and corporate groups used to stay a whole week for Sundance. Now...
They check in Thursday and they're out on Monday.
Collective belt tightening could mean spending less at these events, or maybe not going at all. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Then 2017 comes around.
Not a great year for weather, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 613 points, 1.8% to finish at 33,296. The NASDAQ gave up 138 points, 1.25% to end at 10,957. And the S&P 500 lost 62 points, almost 1.6% to land at 3928. So how did retail stocks do, given the biggest decline in retail sales in a year? Not great. Costco wholesale slipped 1.5%. Home Depot sawed off 1.2%. Kroger and Walgreens Boots Alliance both discounted nearly 2%. Even Amazon had the blues. It slipped 0.6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We spend a lot in this country on national security. Funding in the latest National Defense Authorization Act rounds up to a record $858 billion. And it's no surprise that the industry has long been dominated by men. But there's a growing movement to bring more women into national security jobs. According to a recent story in The 19th, women make up just 20% of the workforce. Reporter Mariel Padilla wrote that story. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is keeping women out of this field of national security?
I think it's a combination of things. It's a lack of visible role models. It's long-standing misconceptions about career pathways available to young women, and stereotypes about what the sector should look like.
Yeah, you open the piece with a Men in Black reference. and those stereotypes are based in a little bit of reality, though, right? I mean, the security guard, the Secret Service member, the bouncer at the bar, usually people we see working in security are men.
Right. Right. I mean, women still account for only about 20% of the national security workforce across the board. And a lot of people attribute this to longstanding ideas that security is about power and control and physical strength. And that might have been the case in the past, but things certainly are changing.
You profiled this group, Girl Security, that is working to change the perception of national security and also get more young women working in the field. How are they going about that?
Yes. So Girl Security is an organization that was started in 2019 by a woman who worked in national security for years. And she left the industry actually for a decade and didn't come back until she realized that the number of women had remained stagnant across the field. And so she is kind of focusing this organization on helping younger women and girls ages 14 through 26 just learn about what kind of pathways are available to them, what kinds of things they can contribute to the national security field, and honestly just figure out who is interested and what they're interested in, because there is a new perspective being brought to what national security looks like from these girls.
What do you think women and people who don't identify as male, the group is open to non-binary folks as well, can bring to this space maybe that has been missing?
Yeah, so I actually talked to some of the young women who are involved with this organization already. I talked to several college students, one high school student, and they told me about how they were able to bring their own ideas to a space that they didn't think that they were allowed in because of the avenues that Girl Security opened up. And so this is things like their interest in climate change issues or food security issues. So just finding ways to make the world a better place from where they were sitting.
You brought up something that really struck me, which is that the experience of growing up female in our society with concerns about our own personal security that come with that can actually be an advantage in terms of, I guess, you know, sort of the vigilance that women might bring to this field.
Absolutely. And the founder talked about this a lot, the founder of Girl Security. She said that girls and women grow up in a state of constant threat to their personal security. And because of this, they innately and intimately understand security in a way that other people might not. And so, for instance, there are people involved with Girl Security who are moms who have been trafficked, parents who have been detained by ICE, first-generation refugees who were resettled here post-conflict. So these are women who have experienced the repercussions of national security decisions that were already made, and they now want to be part of that solution. So it's all about bringing new voices to the table.
Marielle Padilla wrote about gender equity and national security for the 19th. Thanks so much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
As anyone who's endured the past couple of weeks of intense rainfall in California can attest, the severe weather made worse by our warming planet can be deadly and scary. It's also expensive. The reinsurance giant Munich Re says last year, Hurricane Ian, floods in Australia and Pakistan, and other disasters caused $270 billion in losses. About $120 billion of that was insured. One way insurance companies cover their risk of such losses is by selling a special kind of bond to investors. But climate change is also making those bonds riskier. Think Silver Jubilee and maybe a picture of royal celebration. Queen Elizabeth decked out in pearls, a pink dress and matching hat, celebrating the 25th anniversary of her reign.
When I was 21... I pledged my life to the service of our people.
Jubilees are big in the UK. I watched one recently, not for a monarch, but for a financial instrument.
What a treat it is as an American to be invited to a jubilee. We don't have those.
Michael Millette is a managing partner at Hudson Structured Capital Management. And the thing he flew all the way to London to celebrate was the 25th anniversary of the first catastrophe bond.
And when we were working on some of the earliest deals, we had no idea that we would become old war horses, celebrating a jubilee. But
in very simple terms, a cat bond, as they're called, is a form of reinsurance, that is, insurance for insurance companies. The bonds help insurers pay claims by spreading some of their risk to investors. Usually pension funds and hedge funds and the like can buy bonds tied to a specific event or group of events.
Those events can be hurricanes or earthquakes. Those events could be pandemics. They could be all sorts of things.
The money goes into a trust, and the insurance company pays investors a premium to be able to tap that stash of money if a big enough loss occurs and the bond gets triggered. Jennifer Montero is CFO of Citizens Property Insurance Corporation. It's Florida's state-backed insurer for people who can't get private insurance. Last hurricane season, she says cat bonds made up about half the company's reinsurance.
And if the wind doesn't blow, then the investors made a few bucks off their investment, and hopefully they'll redeploy that capital right back into the market again.
So if the wind does blow, they have the potential to lose all their money?
That's correct. Or they could lose part of it.
Of course, the wind did blow in Florida. We'll come back to that later. So why would an investor want to make that bet? Again, Michael Millette.
It's different from betting, because when you sit down to bet, you know that the odds are stacked against you.
With cat bonds, he says?
These are not against everyday events. They're against extreme events. So in most cases, the investors after a year or three will get the money in the trust plus the premiums.
And those premiums can be pretty large. Depending on market conditions, investors can earn anywhere from about 4% to more than 10% on their money. For comparison, a three-year treasury bond is paying less than 4% right now. And for a long time, investors in cat bonds did pretty well.
Then 2017 comes around.
Chris Grimes follows the cat bond market for Fitch, the ratings company. In 2017, hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria hit the U.S. in the space of 4 weeks, causing widespread devastation.
And that was followed by a year in 2018 that had even more hurricanes. And in 2020, you've had some more.
2021 had more hurricanes, like Ida, and there was that big winter storm in Texas. And then last year?
We've got Hurricane Ian that's generated one of the larger losses that we've seen in history. So over that time period, cat bond investors have lost some money.
Billions of dollars. Remember Citizens, the Florida state-backed insurer? Losses from Hurricane Ian weren't large enough to trigger its cat bonds, but some investors in a bond issued by Allstate were likely wiped out. That's according to Artemis, a website that tracks the market. At last fall's Silver Jubilee, the trip down memory lane took a bit of a somber turn. Here's Michael Millette speaking at the event again.
The world is becoming more catastrophic because cat risk appears to be drifting to higher levels due to climate change.
For now, investment in cat bonds keeps growing. But as losses grow too, some worry that could scare off investors at a time when insurance companies need them even more to help cover catastrophic losses. You can hear more about cat bonds and how they might help Florida's broken insurance market on our podcast, How We Survive. This final note on the way out today, it's that time of the every 6 weeks or so when the Beige Book comes out. That's the Fed's regular survey of economic conditions by district, always full of interesting anecdotes. So here are just a few. From Chicago, Contact said, quote, philanthropic organizations continued to face the challenge of balancing increased requests to address basic needs, such as food insecurity, with lower revenues. In Kansas City, home builders mentioned canceled contracts, saying, quote, a bigger cliff of cancellations will hit builders in the spring. And we talked earlier about Hurricane Ian. The Atlanta Fed reports that Florida citrus yields were down notably due to damage from the hurricane. Again, just a sample. From the national summary, this stood out. Context expected little economic growth in the months ahead, but also future price growth, aka inflation, is expected to moderate. Here's your moment of economic context. We told you earlier retail sales have fallen 2 months in a row. One retail chain is struggling more than others. Party City filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy yesterday. It plans to keep stores open while restructuring its debt. A combination of inflation, increased competition, and a helium shortage have weighed on the company's sales. From a regulatory filing, balloons are, quote, a focal point of our growth strategy and are a key driver of our differentiated brand experience. Doesn't work so well without helium, does it? Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Amy Scott. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.